trend on a concrete breakwater at the mouth of the James and stare out at the white caps in the slate ocean as a ferry approached, and he would try to account for those days. See birds wheeling and crying in the high air, dazzling in their whiteness, and him leaning with his thumbs hooked in his trouser pockets and the lower buttons of his frock coats unfastened and the wind whipping his white hair to spume. He was old by then, though not in years, and stiff with a kind of fascinated sorrow for what he had outlived. The slow unfolding of that night, how he managed to withdraw his pistolet from its hiding place behind the headboard and club spar on the temple with the stock, his sudden gasping for air. He had rolled off the bed tangled in the sheets. He remembered the fear, he said. It was like a taste he could not wash from his mouth. The hotel room, he said, was silver and very still in the moonlight, like a room underwater. Then he was standing. Spar had been coming at him with a knife when he raised the gun and fired, and when Spar collapsed, he walked terrified over and stood above him and leveled the pistolet at the dead man's face and pulled the trigger a second time. There was the heavy tread of men on the stairs, and then a long silence, and then his door exploded, the frame splintering and swinging at a crazy angle in to knock the plaster from the wall. A half-dozen Confederate soldiers were shouting at him. In his fear, they looked enormous, hulking. The landing beyond was lit by candles, and in the eerie light, he could see Cashmere smoking quietly, and other residents standing in their open doors, staring wide-eyed in. And then he was being struck to the ground by a sergeant, and his hands twisted behind his back, and his wrists and ankles shackled. His nightshirt was rucked up over his waist. He could not understand how they had arrived so quickly. He raised his head. A sticky black pool of blood was seeping across the floorboards, staining the bedclothes in its ink. He saw the clawed hands of Spar, twisted in death. A stew of teeth and brain and bone, where the face had been. There was blood on his face, but it was not his own. He was dragged like a bag of feed into the street and thrown into the bed of a wagon, and his skull cracked against the boards, and he felt his eyes run. Someone slapped the horse in its traces, and then they were moving slowly through the darkness, and he could smell the rank vinegar smell of pigs in the wood underneath him. But when he raised his head, he saw two soldiers squatting on the wooden rails, with their rifles standing in their fists and their eyes hard on him. He was thinking of Spar. He was thinking of Alan Pinkerton. He could make no sense of what had just happened. His eyes were wet from the stink in the wood, and he turned his face away. They took him to Castle Godwin, its scorched bricks, its terrible slave pens, and he understood, as he was punched and kicked from the wagon, that they would kill him. But they only held him unsteadily while Cashmere unfastened his ankles and frog-marched him across the mud of the yard. There were torches burning in sconces. He could see General Winder standing in a long oiled coat, like a whaling captain just come ashore, and his white hair was uncombed, but he clenched his sharp jaw in disgust and went in before Edward reached him. Inside, men were moaning in their cells. There were stone stairs, wet straw on the floor under barred windows. Doors unlocking, locking. "Am I being charged?" he mumbled. He crushed his eyes shut, opened them. He was coming slowly back to himself. "Captain," he said, "it was self-defense, sir. The man attacked me." Cashmere stood him swaying against a brick wall as a soldier unlocked his cell, and Edward could see figures moving in the darkness beyond, like tall grass in a night wind. Except there was no wind. Cashmere's eyes were lost to shadow. "He was to know the charge," he said. One of the soldiers grinned at him. Edward bared his teeth in fear. "You can't arrest a man for defending himself." "You're not under arrest," Cashmere said. Edward stared at him. "You're not under arrest," he said again. "You're not even here, boy." And then someone had taken his arm and shoved him forward, and they were locking the cell again, and he kneeled there in the faint light, with his wrists still shackled. His jailers paid him no mind. He gritted his bloodied teeth, thinking of Lewis and Scully somewhere in that prison, and that he was closer to them now than he had ever been. He stared with glassy eyes through the bars of his cell, listened to the men around him cough and scratch at their flea bites, feeling weak and whip-thin, a smell of sickness already in his skin, turning it all over in his heart. In the morning they came for him and took him to a stained room with a drain in its floor, like an abattoir, and there they beat him until nightfall. They cut up his face. They did not ask him anything. All week they came for him. "Please," he would say, "please." "Shut his mouth. Shut your goddamn mouth, boy. Please, please." And then the ropes at his wrists would tighten, the crank would click through its gears, hauling him again upward to the ceiling, his shoulders cracking under the strain. Somewhere a man was screaming like a child. One night, the cell door opened, and Mr. Marvell came in and crouched near him and said, "You are in a mighty spot of trouble, son. I don't know as there is anything to be done for you. I'm sorry." Edward closed his eyes, stoppered his ears. When he awoke, the man was gone, and Edward stared at the stone floor where he had been, and he could not say if it had been a nightmare or no. Was it madness in his thinking, or a new clarity? Through all of this, he struggled to make sense of Spar, of the scarred man's cold rage. He remembered a conversation between them, crouched in the grass above Camp Lee, the cicadas in song, a warm orange backlit glow seeping down under the rim of the horizon. He had told Spar he would not go without Lewis and Scully. Spar had sighed, withdrawn a long, slow knife from a sheath under his coat. He stood a moment, turning it in the light, and then said softly, "I can't leave you here, Edward." Edward remembered staring at the weapon, smiling. "What will you do? Murder me?" Spar's smile had faded, pity in his eyes. It was the pity Edward thought about now, curled, shuddering on a pallet of rotting straw at the bottom of a bleak stone cell. That, and the dead man's muttered reply. "Ah, kid, just how much do you think a life is worth? No one sends a man into Richmond that they can't stand to lose." A delicate white spider was crouched 2 inches from his face. It started to move, slowly, away. And at last he understood. He shivered, moaned. He had become a liability. Ignatius Spar was a man of vicious talents, and the Major had sent him to Richmond for a reason, and that reason was not to get Edward out. Spar had been sent to kill him. He got sick. 2 men held his wrist to the arm of a chair, and a third put a bayonet blade through his left hand. The week passed, then a second. One afternoon they came for him, and he lay feverish and moaning in the filthy straw, and they turned him over with their boots, and then they went away. A man came to look at him. He pried back his lips, peered into his throat, unwrapped the bandages from his left hand to look for gangrene. Later a lady stood at the cell bars, holding a cloth to her nose and asking him some muffled questions, but he could not understand her. Someone had given him a pair of shoes, and then, in the night, some other had taken them from him. He lost count of the days. Some part of him understood that he had vanished and would not be heard from again. Then one morning he was taken from the prison in fixed cuffs manufactured in Chicago before the war, and he was loaded into a coach under armed guard. His shirt hung slack and befouled from his shoulder blades like a wet towel from a branch. He stared into a pool of brackish water in the yard and saw his hair standing on end, and the huge whites of his eyes, and the outsized yellow bandages on his hand. His neck looked too thin for his collar. There were 2 soldiers lashing heavy wooden crates onto the rear of the carriage, but he was shoved inside without explanation and sat on the rear bench, with a guard staring in at him through the open door. The guard was very young, younger even than Edward. He was bored. He was cold. Edward felt the carriage sway as each crate was loaded. He did not care about any of it. He shook his head and the blood moved inside his skull like water in a half-empty jug. He asked weakly where they were taking him. The young soldier grinned. "To hell," he said. "Please," Edward begged. "Are we going north? Is it an exchange?" But the guard only pulled at his peeling upper lip, leaned against the carriage door, shrugged. There were two horses, which meant they were to travel at speed. But when the coach turned south outside Richmond, and then west, Edward felt his hopes fade. The sun slid across the sky, eased into the west ahead of them. They rode roughly onward into the setting sun over the washed-out roads, and the red light drenched the carriage and lit their faces a violent red, and he closed his eyes to see it. On the second day he thought they must be riding for Texas. That evening they stopped at dusk at a roadside inn at the edge of a high field, and he could see the still shapes of cows grazing there, and he looked at the sky and wondered if he would soon be dead. They would leave his body to be pulled apart by dogs in some distant pasture. The stars were already out, and wheeled right down to the horizon. The two soldiers sat inside for a long time, leaving Edward handcuffed to the carriage in his thin clothes, and listening to what sounded like artillery in the distance. He did not try to escape. When they returned, they brought some meat and bread wrapped in an oilcloth for him, but he could not eat it, and his guard shrugged and set it aside. "Don't eat, then," his guard said, but there was something new in it. Pity, maybe. They rode into the night. A lantern had been lit on either side of the driver, and cast a weak, swaying light over their faces, and Edward felt the eerie strangeness of that journey in his bones. It was river country. It was hill country. They crossed several bridges and went on in silence, and there was an uneasiness in the young guard that made Edward wonder, through his fever, if they were nearing Union lines. He felt the coach dip. He felt it rise. He heard the clatter of hooves on hammered planks, and then the slow rolling thunder of the coach wheels as they reached a larger bridge. He could hear the river under them, and all at once there was an enormous cracking sound, and he felt a sudden jolt, and he was thrown forward onto the floor. The guard across from him had braced himself with one hand on the roof, and a boot kicked forward against the door, and he was staring in sudden alarm out the window, even as Edward felt the coach begin to slide. "Captain Red!" the guard was hollering. "Captain!" Edward swore. The horses were screaming. And all at once, the roof was rising to meet him, and he felt the soldier's elbow sharp in his spine, and there was a long, weightless moment, and then one wall smashed with a bracing violence into the river. Something struck his face. Water poured through both windows in a black foam and engulfed them, and he felt himself knocked powerfully backward and under, and then he could not breathe. He spun. He kicked out hard. His hands were still cuffed before him, and he pushed himself upward and gasped in a small crevice of air, and he felt the water rising fast. The bandages on his left hand felt huge, heavy. He could see the soldier in the far corner, gasping also, and he felt the boy's legs kick out and strike his ribs, and he grunted and went under again. Then he had taken hold of the boy's shoulder and was pushing him under and lifting himself into the air, and he could feel the boy thrashing under him there. He had twisted his body up to fill the narrow slash of air, and the young soldier struggled but could not get up. Then the soldier went still, started to drift. The water was dark and very cold. The confusion of it was what he would remember. The feeling of weightlessness, and the strange, impossible uncertainty as to which direction was up. The weight of his boots and clothes was dragging him down, and he kicked and writhed and struggled through the small window. His boot caught on the door, and then somehow it gave way, and he was out and kicking for the surface of the river. He surfaced in an explosion of breath, with his hands over his head and his face streaming. There was blood in his eyes, in his mouth. He saw no sign of the older captain. He rode his elbows oar-like through the mud of the shore, and hunched his hips, and slithered and dragged and sawed himself, gasping, up onto the riverbank, rolled onto his back, his chest heaving, and his boots still in the current. He could not have said how long he lay in that place, his wrists bound before him, his head thrown back, his white throat naked and soft. He was sick, and he slept shivering, and he dreamed the cottonwoods uprooted themselves, and came down the riverbank, and dipped their branches in his mouth and drank from him. He could hear the river on the stones, and when he lifted his face, he saw the wreckage of the carriage, its wheels standing splintered in the foam, its doors staved in, and he saw the huge, soaked mounds of the horses, half submerged in the current, and the waters pulling at their manes. Where should have stood a bridge stood now only pilings and sky. The sun slid behind the trees. The forest darkened and grew cold. He slept. He opened a feverish eye. Something was moving through the mud in the gloom. He closed his eye. At some point, the river paled to a molten silver. Dawn came on. Edward was shaking and very sick, and when he raised his head, he saw a bearded man in a patched coat come down to the river on the far bank and stare across at the wreckage of the Confederate coach, and he made no sound when he vanished back into the trees. When he next lifted his head, the man was nudging him in the ribs with the toe of one boot. Edward grunted in pain. The man left him and sat and pulled off his boots and trousers, and he folded his ragged coat and shirt over a branch, and he waded out into the river, looking pink as a plucked chicken with a line of grime at his throat and wrists. He returned dragging from the river a low raft, piled with rope and Confederate boxes, and four boots, and the two Enfield rifles all salvaged from the swamped coach, and then the man was bending over him, turning out his pockets, and Edward was too weak to protest. He was a very big man, bearded and thin like a starved ox. His collarbone stood stark and his shoulders sharp, and his every rib was articulated in the sunlight. There was a savagery in his crooked nose and fierce thin lips, and Edward thought for a long and terrible moment that he had been found by one of the Comanche. But then the man kneeled and scooped Edward into his arms, and he carried him through the cottonwoods and along a ravine and up into the hills. The man's hands were gentle, his skin dry as snakeskin. He laid Edward, frail and trembling, upon a blanket. He offered him water. He took out a pouch from under his coat and poured several long iron keys onto the ground and selected one and unlocked Edward's cuffs. These he pocketed carefully. He stripped Edward from his coat and trousers, and he rolled him into the dry blanket and carried him nearer the fire. He said nothing. A day passed, perhaps two. It was at dusk that Edward awoke at last, and he found himself in a high encampment, propped against the wall of a stockade, and the man who had saved him was watching him from near the fire. They were alone. He seemed to be a tinker, and his cart stood nearby with a canvas shell stretched across it, and his very tools laid out for the working of leather and metals, and a starved horse stood some ways off, regarding them with a single terrified eye. "You ain't dead, then," the tinker said. His voice was hoarse from long disuse, and he spoke with a strange, bent accent, like an Englishman, but not like an Englishman. Whatever he was no southerner. Edward's tongue felt huge, dry as a sponge in his mouth. He swallowed painfully. "You got a name?" the tinker said. When Edward still said nothing, the tinker busied himself at the fire, scraping a pan over the stones, and something sizzled. Edward shut his eyes, opened his eyes. The streaks on the man's sleeves where he had cleaned his knife. The twin Enfield stacked against a log. Shaking his huge, shaggy head, he squinted one eye as if to take the boy's measure, and there was something new in it, a kind of menace.
"I recognize that look," he said.
Edward raised his slow head.
"Like a cat staring down a hole. Just what sort of men are ye?"
Edward's teeth were clenched. He was shaking with fever. Firelight shone slick on the stones. "Just what sort," he said, "are you?" Steeling himself for a fight. The huge tinker studied him, then all at once he grinned. He had a tooth out in front. Edward balled up his fists. But the giant only held out a hand, huge and black as if seamed with coal.
"Easy now. If I were going to kill you, you'd be dead already," he chuckled. "My name's Flood."
"Flood?"
"Aye. And behold, I do bring a flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh, wherein is the breath of life from under heaven."
The tinker's eyes were very dark and strange as he spoke. After a moment, he added softly,
"And everything that is in the earth shall die."
Edward glanced around at the encroaching darkness. "How long you been alone up here?" he asked. The man Flood grinned and grinned.
"Long enough to find God,"
he said.
and long enough to lose him. "It's not courage if you're not afraid," the major would say. Cigar smoke, like a strange incense in the fabric of his tent, his shirt sleeves rolled back, beard wild, the big pre-war map of the valley laid flat on the table before them. "A man who doesn't know fear is a man I don't trust," he would say. "But it's what you do with the fear that matters." Or he would set his big hand on the boy's hat and crush it down over his eyes as the cavalry rode out in clouds of red dust and say, "A man can be read just like a book. You can flip through him and find the page you want." Edward, who had watched Alan Pinkerton and loved him, who had studied the way the older man's eyes in a crowded room were always moving into the corners, towards the swell of curtains or the opening of doors, studied his ropey forearms and the bullish sinews in his neck, and the way he would chomp down on a cigar through his bristling beard, as if he would bite any hand that came near him. The major was gruff and strict and quick to shout, but he did not shout at Edward, even the once, and there was ever a gentleness in his eye when he looked at the boy. He said he himself lived without fear, and that this was only possible because he was so often afraid. At sunset on that fateful night, he had stood with Edward, while the porters crouched in the muck, inspecting axle and harness, and he had told Edward he wished he could go with him. He said, "I will find a way to bring you back." One gnarled hand gripping the boy's shoulder, the crease as his blue eyes hardened.
"You won't have to," said the boy. "I'll bring them back, sir. Both of them."
"Look at ye," the man said. "You could be my own son, lad."
The Eye That Never Sleeps. 1885. London. 36.
"No one noticed it was gone, sir. Not all weekend."
Blackwell's scuffed bowler was drawn firmly down to his eyeline, his shoulders swaying with the growler.
"Not until Mr. Farquhar found the letter, that is," he added.
The driver rattled over some sort of obstruction and turned a sharp corner, and Shaw put out a strong red-knuckled hand and gripped the door.
"What letter?"
he said. "The letter in Mr. Farquhar's study, sir. It contains rather explicit instructions."
The growler struck another loose stone and Shaw glowered.
"Instructions?"
Blackwell sat with his fists clutched between his knees and his shoulders swaying side to side. The pale cloth of his trousers was streaked with soot from his fingers. He nodded uneasily and he said,
"Yes, sir. Instructions, sir."
"What kind of instructions?" "As to how the painting will be negotiated back," William interrupted impatiently.
He blew out his cheeks and put a violent hand to the seat beside him as the growler swung around again, and he turned to Blackwell and said,
"Do you have this letter now? Who's been in contact with it?"
The inspector fumbled with his pockets and unbuttoned his greatcoat, and reached into its lining and withdrew the crumpled envelope. Shaw moved to take it, but William reached past with his calfskin gloves still on, and very carefully he pried the envelope open and poured the letter out onto the seat beside him. He was careful to touch only two of its corners as he unfolded it. The stationery was an expensive cardstock with a London watermark, and the writing was in the tall, elegant hand of a man with skill and a desire to show it.
"Who's handled this?" he said. "I mean, besides Farquhar and yourself."
Blackwell shook his head.
"I should think Mr. Farquhar's wife, perhaps. Perhaps the constable who interviewed them."
A sudden latticing of shadow and light as they passed under a railway arch and on. William peered down to the bottom of the page and turned it carefully, and held it to the light, and then he looked up.
"Well," said Shaw, "what does it say?"
William looked at Blackwell a long moment.
"It says the Emma has been temporarily removed from the gallery, for the purposes of safekeeping. It says there have been rumors of criminal intent towards it, and in the interests of preserving a work of national interest, the interested parties have taken it upon themselves to protect it, etc."
He cleared his throat, scanned ahead.
"The painting can be negotiated back for a fee covering the costs incurred. A representative will make contact with Mr. Farquhar."
Here William squinted, held the letter high in the light of the carriage window. in the next few days, etc. No charges are to be laid, as no criminal offence is intended. Police are not to be involved. It mentions you directly.
It mentions me? Shaw scowled. Give it over.
You're not wearing gloves.
To hell with gloves. Give it to me.
But William frowned and waited, and after a long, angry moment, Shaw drew on his heavy gloves. William handed the letter across. Shaw was shaking his head.
Please advise Mr. John Shaw of Scotland Yard that his presence is not encouraged.
Is this a joke?
The growler lifted onto two wheels, then rattled, banging back down as it swung around a corner, and William was thrown heavily against Blackwell.
Where did you say this was found?
He said, picking the inspector's bowler from the floor.
In Mr. Farquhar's study, sir.
At his residence.
They could hear the driver cursing his horses.
Indeed, sir.
Blackwell was regarding William with interest.
It seemed it was propped against a lamp on his desk, sir,
where Mr. Farquhar keeps his private papers. One supposes it was left there on purpose so that it wouldn't be overlooked.
It was found this morning.
Yes, sir.
Nothing else missing.
Shaw glared.
The keys to the gallery? Papers? Mrs. Farquhar's diamonds, for God's sake?
No, sir, nothing.
Not according to Mr. Farquhar. William reached across and carefully took the letter from Shaw and slid it into his inner pocket.
The thief didn't take the keys because he didn't need to, he said calmly. This is no amateur. He bloody well is. Overlooks her diamonds, but takes a painting. You can't fence a picture like the Emma.
He doesn't need to fence it.
If George Farquhar refuses to negotiate, the thief has nothing. A painting he can't unload.
William grimaced. But he won't refuse. It's still more profitable for Farquhar to pay out than to lose the painting entirely. Just then the carriage struck another bulge in the stones of the roadway and set their teeth ajar, and Shaw cursed and reached through his window and rapped on the roof. The carriage drew tight into the street's edge. The chief inspector swung open the door and climbed, swearing, down.
We'll walk the rest of the way, he snapped at the driver. It's not a bloody derby, man.
William had come to the gallery at Shaw's invitation. Good Mr. Farquhar suffered a misfortune, the chief inspector had said, and William thought at once of Fool, prowling the upper rooms of Farquhar's mansion. Edward Shade's fingerprints lay carefully labelled and packaged on the writing desk at his hotel, and there would soon be an agency file on Shade, and then a rogue's gallery entry, and then the man, Shade, Fool, some other, would be caught the next time he committed a crime. His father had hunted the thief for years and never come so close. Close, he thought, surprised by the unhappiness in the thought. Having traced and recorded the man ought to be enough. It was not. He thought of Charlotte Reckitt, pickled in that mortuary cabinet. He thought of Blackwell's doubts as to her identity. He thought of powerful Ben Porter, collapsed in a rat-infested tenement, his ancient widow somewhere now on her way to California. He thought of his own father, mouldering in the black earth in Chicago. All of their parts in it were finished. There was a watery yellow fog in the air, burning his vision, and William rubbed the heels of his palms at his eyes as he walked. The cold of the morning crept in under his collar. It was an old, macadamized street, with the stones pulled sharply up over the years, and with stone bollards set every few paces along the shop fronts to keep the carriages from molesting the passers-by. Their footfalls were loud in the fog, and William could hear Blackwell sniffling as they walked, and in irritation he reached into his waistcoat for a handkerchief and handed it across. A dray clattered past in the fog, ghost-like, blurred. They turned a corner and came out at Bond Street, and there were silhouettes moving in the mists, and Shaw jogged across the Sunday traffic, and William followed with his silk hat low on his head, and Blackwell was behind them in the mist like a wraith. As they approached, a long, thin figure detached itself and drifted towards them.
"Look what's crept out of its lair,"
Shaw muttered, and then louder.
"It seems you have beaten us to the quarry, sir."
There was a tightness around Breck's grey eyes, and he glanced at Blackwell in distaste before saying sourly,
"I have warned you, Mr. Shaw. If you do not instruct your constables not to interfere with a crime scene, I shall be of no use to you."
Shaw rubbed his gloves together.
Aye, so you have. Mr. Blackwell, please see if anyone is still here. The night watchman, perhaps?
No use at all, Breck repeated. I mean that. I have other matters to attend to at the hospital. They are no less pressing.
Dr. Breck, William interrupted, what have you found?
Other than that the London Constabulary Force is made up in equal measure of cattle and of feed?
William smiled.
Other than that, yes.
Breck turned his back and kneeled at the edge of the street, running his fingers through the mud in its grooves, and he said,
You, at least, Mr. Pinkerton, will appreciate what I have found.
He stood and turned twice on the spot and stared with pouched eyes at the ground, and William saw the knees of his trousers were black with muck. The doctor turned and held up a vial of reddish liquid.
Do you know what this contains?
Blackwell had just emerged from the gallery and was approaching through the fog as Breck spoke, and he said,
Does it contain the solution, sir?
Breck gave him a sharp, mistrustful look.
The solution?
To the problem, sir.
Ah, Breck scowled. Amusing.
Blackwell smiled politely and rubbed at his cold nose and said,
Mr. Shaw, sir, the night watchman is still inside. Seems he heard nothing. Noticed nothing amiss until this morning when Mr. Farquhar arrived having found the letter. It was then they went upstairs to the gallery and discovered the theft together. He says he has no idea when it happened or how.
That is because he was asleep, Breck said. You'll want to talk to him, William said to Shaw.
Breck glanced coolly across.
You'll be assisting in this investigation, Mr. Pinkerton?
Never mind him, Shaw said. What did you find? Breck ran a filthy hand along his neck.
Ah, the man you are looking for is slight of build. He is small, but athletic. He did not come in a cab or in a carriage. He climbed to the gallery alone using the outside of the building, but he had an accomplice waiting here below. He is well-dressed, a gentleman, and he was recently in America. He has been in the gallery several times over the past few weeks, and is a professional criminal recently in trouble with the law. Not here, but overseas, most likely in the United States.
William listened to all this, feeling the gears clicking in his mind. And he paused, and he studied the thin doctor, and then he said, quietly,
How can you know all that?
You see what you expect to see, the doctor said impassively.
I expect nothing.
He gestured at the street. The only recent wheel grooves standing at the curb are from a single wide-gauge wheel, which suggests a private carriage. Hansoms are narrow-gauge. As it last rained early Saturday evening, but only lightly, and as there is only one impress in the mud, it is reasonable to assume this carriage belongs to Mr. Farquhar, whom I know arrived at the gallery this morning. Therefore, the thief arrived here on foot. There is a smudge of white chalk on the underside of the window ledge, which I am certain will also be found on the upper side. This will be from the thief's fingers. It is smudged because he has tried to conceal his fingerprints. This means his fingerprints are likely to give him away, and that he knows this, which in turn suggests he is both familiar with the technique of fingerprinting and fearful that his prints will be recognized. This is a recent technique, only coming into use in the last few years, and only, so far, in Argentina, France, and the United States. Therefore, he has been handled by the authorities in one of these countries at some point recently. He will have been well-dressed so as to draw little attention to himself as he walked through this area late at night, and either he or his acquaintance must have been recently in America as he was smoking this cheroot, which is an American brand, and somewhat expensive. Breck was gesturing with the toe of his scuffed shoe to the ground down heel of a small cigarillo. None of that would stand as evidence, William said.
It does not matter. It is correct.
Justice isn't a matter of correctness, Doctor.
No, it's a matter of proof.
Breck gave him a strange, dark smile.
Justice, he said softly, as if tasting the word.
The gas in the sconces was standing at a high flame, casting a corona of light up the walls. A man's footfalls echoed through the galleries ahead, then faded, and as they went upstairs, Shaw said,
It's the same damn thing with that scarecrow always.
Breck? Blackwell. William pulled off his wet gloves. I didn't know he was a problem.
Shaw barked a laugh.
Not a problem. Seems his theory on that girl's head we fished from the Thames might pay out after all. A publican, missing wife. He's done his digging. Fine detective work. I told you all this last week.
Yes. The Charlotte Records case.
Shaw shrugged. We're calling it the Thames case now. You have doubts, too.
Not doubts. An open mind.
Shaw put a hand on William's arm, slowed. I have a favour to ask. Mr. Blackwell means to confront the man, this publican, tomorrow. And you don't think he can handle it. Whoever did this to that woman is not a fellow to take lightly. I'd hate to have a second head in the river.
William thought of the severed head in its jar, and at the savage wounds on the torso, and he nodded.
Okay.
Shaw studied William as if reconsidering his request, and then he grunted and turned away.
This painting, he said, this Emma, it seems some industrialist in America has had an eye on it. The papers have been claiming he's one of two probable high bidders against some French aristocrat. You don't suppose one of them is involved?
It's more likely Farquhar himself.
You're not serious.
William looked at the chief inspector's appalled face and smiled.
No, he said. I guess not. But I do know this. When the press gets wind of this, it's sure to increase the notoriety of that painting. And the more famous, the more valuable. Farquhar sells paintings for more than you'll see in a lifetime. He knows how the market works. You'll want to talk to him.
Shaw led him into a high-ceilinged gallery with plaster mouldings running the span and naked wood boards which rattled loosely as they walked. Flat on the floor lay an empty gold frame, a thin, ragged strip of canvas along its perimeter. The velvet rope on its stand had been upended, and one end was stiff with some sort of paste. On the wall, a picture wire dangled naked and forlorn where the portrait had hung. The lone window stood closed but unlocked, and when William crossed to it, he could just make out soot smudges on the inner sill.
Is Breck finished in here?
Aye. Shaw bit down hard on the stem of his pipe, but did not trouble to light it. William walked in a wide approach to the picture frame and crouched down beside it.
Tell me about this night watchman, he said. He lowered his face until his eyes were level with the back of the frame.
Name's Owen Archer, Shaw said. A retired soldier, served in India for years. Swears he heard nothing, saw nothing. Blackwell's inclined to believe him. A job like this usually has a man on the inside. You think I should bring him in?
Probably.
William furrowed his brow.
The painting was cut carefully from its frame. Whoever did this knew what they were doing, and they didn't want to damage the painting. That means either they mean to sell it, which is unlikely, or to keep it for themselves, which would require a queer sort of passion. Or else what? Or else they obviously mean to honor the terms of the letter. To return it undamaged.
Shaw grunted.
Looks pretty damaged to me. The thief came in and out through the window, as Breck suspects. William said,
that means he's agile and strong, but also small. He would have needed someone to stand lookout below, but this would be a small job. A professional job. You'll be looking for a slight man, a professional criminal who is clever enough to have avoided being implicated. Most likely he has a heavy-set and tall accomplice who could help him scale the wall. The letter was deposited Saturday evening or on Sunday. Most likely the former, which means either this thief or one of his accomplices was present at the party. By invitation, one presumes, to arouse no undue suspicion. Brett thinks he's come over from America.
Sound like anyone we know.
Shaw gave him a look.
Sounds a little bit like you, he said.
William smiled a wolfish smile.
If I were the thief, I'd want the perfect alibi. And what better than to have been seen at Farquhar's own residence that night?
But there's something he wasn't counting on.
What?
Fingerprints.
Breck said he didn't leave any trace.
William withdrew the letter from his pocket with great care, and held it out by one corner.
This is his mistake.
Have Dr. Breck dust this. Shaw stared at him in amazement. Why would he leave his fingerprints on that, if he was so damned careful with the rest? The letter was deposited before our little demonstration, John. The theft was executed after. When he left this, he didn't have to worry about his fingerprints yet. Shaw stared at him. He shook his head. You and your bloody Edward Shade, he muttered. You think everything comes back to him. Everything does, said William. 37. Fool woke early and lay with his eyes open in the darkness, listening. Somewhere above him, Charlotte slept, her warm skin soft under sheets. The knowledge of it burned inside him like a slow-breathing ember, and after a while, he shifted onto his side, the mattress creaking under his elbow. He drew the blankets tight in a huddle and he stared at the shapes of the furniture. He had never imagined her like this. The haunted weariness around her eyes, as if she were squinting at him from some small point very far away. The hair hanging in strangled ropes over her eyes. A slash of light at her throat like a knife. And then her voice. He had stared at her as the night coalesced coldly in her hair and poured into her eyes. And then he had looked down and seen her small traveler's case standing at her feet, and felt Mrs. Sykes's hand on his arm and had stepped aside. He remembered Mrs. Sykes bundling her into a blanket, clicking her tongue the while, giving Flood a strange, unreadable look.
Come now, love, she was saying. Let's get you in out of that weather.
Molly had already dissolved back into the stairwell, only the whites of her eyes visible.
You were dead, Fool had said. I saw your body.
Charlotte looked at him, uncertain. She pulled off her gloves, finger by finger, and rested a cold hand against his cheek, as if in answer. He could feel it still, the pressure of that hand. He ran his fingers lightly over his face as if her touch had left some trace on him. After a moment, he rose from the bedsheets. He danced across the freezing floorboards. He dipped his fingers in the basin on his washstand. He rubbed at his face and throat. He splashed his armpits. He shivered. Despite his exhaustion, a quiet triumph was building in him, something delicious and impossible and sacrosanct. Somewhere overhead, Charlotte lay dreaming. Somewhere, Charlotte breathed. He opened his wardrobe soundlessly. The looking glass on the interior door flared like open water, flared and then darkened. Fool dressed quickly and went out past the landing and down. He knew Mrs. Sykes would be awake, already stirring the ashes in the kitchen. But the candles in their sconces had not been lit. The parlour was cold. He passed through into the emporium and he saw a light underneath a door, and these rooms were warmer. But when he went in to greet his housekeeper, he stopped in the doorway, surprised.
I thought you'd be sleeping, he said.
Charlotte turned at the fire, her hands held out before her. The deep purple lines under her eyes, the skin at her mouth, drawn and grey.
I couldn't sleep, she said. I haven't been sleeping much.
He did not know what to say.
I lit the fire. I hope I did not overstep.
But she did not finish, and her words drifted away and she lowered her face. He shut the door. He approached slowly, as if entering a dream. She wore a pale green dress he had seen on Hetty, and the sleeves were short at the wrists. Her skin was ethereal and white, and with her black hair loose, she looked a visitant from some other world. Watching her, he had all at once the uneasy sense that a stranger stood inside her, peering back at him with a sinister and vicious intent. But then her features shifted, and he saw the girl he had known, and he understood. Inside him lurked just such a stranger also.
What is it? She said,
the glint of her eyes watching his. He swallowed.
I just thought, well,
it's been so long. A faint smile.
You got old, too, she said.
He blushed and looked away. The fire burned on. They said nothing for a time, unfamiliar, uneasy. Fool stood flexing his hands on the back of the reading chair, and after a time, Charlotte rose and drifted across to a tall shelf, her pale fingers moving soundlessly over the objects there. The walled stone of an ammonite. A set of salt-rusted leather journals. A wooden crate filled with coins dug from the earthworks at Nantes.
"I spoke to Gabriel and Rose," he said at last. "They think you're dead. I had Mr. Flood into half the flash houses in London, making inquiries. No one seemed to know much. Gabriel heard a rumour Pinkerton had burked you." He looked up. "I tracked down the Saracen." She looked back over the scoop of a shoulder. "Cooper?"
"I found him at the Lascars." She took this in, surprised, perhaps, that he had learned of her arrangements with the man.
"There isn't much of him left," Fool added.
He paused. "I'm sorry."
"Cooper was dead years ago," she said in a flat voice. "He just didn't know it."
She reached up with two hands and smoothed and twisted her dark hair over one shoulder, and she said,
"We had our differences. But I wouldn't have wished black pudding on him. He'd have cut his own throat if he'd known he'd end up like that."
But there was no kindness in her tone, and Fool noticed the set of her mouth, and wondered at how the years had hardened her. The logs cracked in the grate, a soft, rapid popping, a shower of ashes blown upward. Fool felt his hands tighten on the back of the chair. He stared at her and forced the pity he felt into a small hard knot in his heart. He said,
"Where have you been, Charlotte?"
She looked away, her face reluctant.
"I thought you were dead. You must have known I was here." "I heard you were looking. Yes."
"You've been in London, then?" She nodded. "And yet you never contacted me. You never sent word." She turned, hands clasped before her.
"Why would I contact you?
You've been arm in arm with William Pinkerton.
I saw your Mr. Flood with him outside a coffee house in Haymarket."
"Pinkerton was hunting your killer," he said softly.
"My killer?
Your killer, yes." She stepped forward and stood beside her chair and said,
"But William Pinkerton knows I didn't die."
Fool studied her, the play of firelight along her arm, her throat.
"He saw me. Last month. He followed me in the street. Why else would I have been in hiding all this time?"
He could think of many reasons, but he did not voice them. He told himself her secrets were hers by right, and it was not his place to interrogate them, and he pinched his eyes shut as if to convince himself.
"Molly and Japheth will have questions," he said instead. "And you? You must have questions also."
He shrugged.
"It isn't my business." "It might be."
"Well,
what is it?"
"The detective you mentioned in your letter. In December. That was Pinkerton."
"Yes."
"What did he want? How did he find you?" She ran an abrupt hand over her throat.
"I didn't know who he was. An American detective in London? He could have followed me for months. I'd not have suspected."
"How did you sight him?"
"I thought it was chance." "It wasn't."
"He let you?"
"He let me. He tipped his hat and held my eye in the underground one day. Then he tailed me across half of London and I couldn't shake him. The next day he came to my door and pressed the buzzer and left. He did that every morning for a week. He knew I was inside. He knew I wouldn't open the door to him. I thought it over and started to get cross, and the next time he came I invited him inside to tea. He declined. That was when he told me his name. He left me his card."
"What did he want?" Charlotte gave him a long, level look, as if expecting him to answer his own query. Lowered her eyes.
She said, "He'd followed me for weeks. At first it was nothing, a nuisance. It complicated my intentions for greasing my uncle from Millbank, true, but nothing more. Then it grew threatening. Watching my house at night. Footprints on the carpets when I came home. Once I was standing in the footway of Potter Street, and someone pushed me into the traffic, and I was nearly run down. It was him."
Fool did not think that sounded like William Pinkerton. But then he knew, too, the nature of that man and how mercurial it could be. He said,
That was when you sent me the letter. That was when I wrote you, yes. I got your letter on Christmas Eve. She said nothing. I never expected to hear from you. After your uncle was arrested, I'd hoped to. For years, I hoped. I didn't think it would happen. She wet her lips. She started to say something and then stopped.
What was between us?
She said instead.
I have always cherished it. But it's in the past.
He nodded, feeling a quick, sharp pain.
You are not who you were either, Adam.
He nodded.
I was married,
she said. I'd heard. Yes. He cleared his throat. He paused.
You were married?
Not still.
I waited for you,
she said abruptly, a bitterness creeping in.
Did you know? I waited months.
I lived in my uncle's lodgings in Whitechapel for 6 months, until the rent was due. You had the address. You could have written.
You did not.
He nodded unhappily. He stared into the fire, remembering.
I was young. I was angry.
You were foolish.
He smiled vaguely. That, too.
I thought I'd been mistaken in you. I thought my uncle was right.
There was something in her expression both plaintive and miserable, and then it was gone.
Right about what?
Charlotte gave him a long, quiet look. She said,
3 weeks after I'd returned, a visitor arrived at my uncle's door. I recognized him at once. It was the French merchant from our hotel in Port Elizabeth. He had been informing on us, watching us. My uncle knew all about us. I remember he called me into his study. The Frenchman said you'd arranged a buyer to meet you in Brindisi. He said you'd already cheated us, that before your journey north you'd established for a transfer of funds to a private bank in Venice. He said you'd confided all this to a man at a campfire in the veldt.
Her eyes watched his as if for some sign, some recognition.
My uncle left for Brindisi in a fury. He did not allow me to go. He was gone 6 weeks, and when he came back, well, the inspectors were waiting for him on the pier. I did not ever see him free again.
I was sick in Brindisi, Charlotte. I was in a fever.
In prison, he said you'd threatened us. He had a letter, written in your hand, justifying your claim to the diamonds and denying me.
His left hand was in bandages. He said you'd attacked him with a knife in an alley near the port. That never happened.
No?
For God's sake! Fool shook his head. He turned away. He turned back. I had nothing. No money. Nothing. I couldn't even walk. Martin betrayed me. He took the diamonds and left me.
I know.
I couldn't make sense of it. Why would he do it? Why cross me?
For love,
she said simply. Fool paused and studied her. He was not sure of her meaning. I visited him a few weeks ago, he said, in the Tench. I wanted to tell him about you, about what had happened. Fool cleared his throat. He told me there'd been a child. She was quiet. I didn't know, he said. If I had known it then, that you were. Her eyes weighed him a moment.
Did he tell you it was yours? Is that what my uncle said?
Wasn't it?
No.
Fool felt his face darken.
I was pregnant 2 years after Port Elizabeth, Adam, she said. It wasn't yours.
She stood unmoving, her white hands clasped before her, hair in a curtain fall over her cheek.
He wasn't yours,
she said again.
He,
Fool murmured. You had a son. Her own voice came low, soft.
Does it appall you to hear this?
It was like the poor thing just gave up.
I was afraid from the very moment I held him. He never made a sound, not for 2 days.
She looked at him.
I have made my peace with it.
Fool swallowed.
He looked like his father. David was a forksman and a grifter. David Aldergate, daring, quick, strong. You'd have liked him.
I don't know that love was a part of it, but we made an effective team. What else was I to do? We left London for Kent in the autumn, where he started a grift, using me as the lure. I'd been recently widowed, had lost my inheritance to relatives in Scotland. David was my loyal manservant, worried for my safety and for the child's. There was a baroness living in that vicinity, who was known to have lost her own grandchild due to similar circumstances. It went well at first, and when the baby came, the baroness stepped in and brought us on to her estate, and we lived for a while in comfort. She believed our account.
Fool could hear the street waking beyond the windows, a peddler crying hoarsely.
It went well, and then it didn't, as always happened. We had to flee in the night, and David had a trunk of the old woman's silver strapped to our carriage, and we rode fast. The carriage went off the road. We were stranded. It was the middle of winter.
The baby
died. And David died the next year in a road accident in Newcastle. I think he never forgave himself. Our marriage was ashes by then.
Charlotte breathed quietly and said nothing for a long while, and then she said,
I grew ill after Kent. I wanted to die too.
He stared at her. It felt all at once as if no time had passed, as if a hole had opened in their lives and they had slipped through to the intimacy they had known before, but awash now in sadness. She held out her wrists to him, and he could see the white cross-hatching of old scars.
I have lost too much, she said simply. I do not wish to lose any more.
Fool nodded.
The tench is closing, Adam. They mean to send my uncle to Portsmouth, to the hulks there. He'll die. He'll rot in them and die, and I shall never see him again.
She made some small gesture with her hand.
I did not want to ask it of you. Gabriel thought you might be willing.
Fool stared at the fire.
I came to London for you, not for your uncle.
It is the same thing.
He frowned.
He's to be transported Wednesday. I have a guard who will arrange a miscount at a roadhouse in Heyshot, in Chichester. I'll be there to spirit him away.
Wednesday.
3 days from now. Yes.
She frowned as if watching for some betrayal in him.
This wasn't how I'd arranged it, she said. My uncle wasn't due to be transported until the spring.
But you'll attempt it regardless.
I must.
She met his eye. There was no recrimination in it, no bitterness, only a long, languid sadness. He felt again that sense of a second Charlotte, a shadow figure glancing sidelong from under her hair. She curled her fingers over the back of the sofa, stood very still, and after a moment she said,
Pinkerton kept asking about someone. A Mags man he was hunting. Some man Shade. Edward Shade.
The clock ticked in the gloom. A log shifted on the fire and a soft hiss of sparks burst in the grate and was drawn up into the blackness.
It's you, isn't it?
She said.
It's you he was looking for. You are this Edward Shade.
Why would you think that?
Tell me I'm mistaken.
A quick, incredulous smile. A weak daylight was creeping across the far shelves, creeping towards them. He could hear in the house above them Molly and Flood, waking, stamping about.
Adam?
Edward Shade's been dead a long time, he said at last, and the dead don't come back. She shook her head at that.
I did,
she said. 38.
Talk of the dead and hear them choke.
Blackwell came to the hotel the next morning. It was Tuesday. William was standing at a window fastening his cufflinks when he saw the inspector unfold, bat-like, down from a four-wheeler in the street below. The man held his hat out before him, and he wiped at its crest with a sleeve, then stared abruptly up at William. The sheen of glass concealed him, but still he stepped back in alarm. He had heard nothing further from Scotland Yard about the stolen painting, and supposed Blackwell had come with some word. But he had not come about that.
The woman from the Thames, William said to him in surprise.
He left the door standing open and turned away, speaking over one shoulder.
You've finished your inquiries, then?
Yes, sir. It's the man I told you about, the publican.
William wrestled into his frock coat, adjusted his collar with his thick, scarred fingers. And not Charlotte Reckitt.
No, sir.
Blackwell's voice was low, urgent. If you'd care to fetch your hat, sir. John mentioned you might come by. And now Blackwell smiled a shy smile. It was a strange sight, and all at once the funereal visage William had come to know dissolved, and in its place was the face of a still young man, an anxious, tired, excited young man. William reached over the inspector's brushed bowler and took his own hat down from its peg, and he held it upside down in his big hands as if it were very fragile, as if the nothing it held was rare and of great worth.
"Show me," he said.
They rode slowly through the crush of traffic in an open hansom with a wool blanket, heavy with damp, shared between them, and the smell of the wet reminded William of riding single file in the rain through the hills outside Santa Fe, with a rifle strapped to his saddle. The streets were filled with carts and skeletal horses with heads low, and laborers with great piles of goods on their backs, and women in rags and shawls hauling barrows of laundry. A miserable crush of hogs shouldered its way around them, snorting. As they went, Blackwell told them what he had learned. Her name was Ellen Shorter, and she had been barmaid and then wife to a tavern keeper in a northwest district of London. The tavern was named the Baker's Dwarf, and despite his name, the man Shorter had not founded it, but had bought it out of receivership some 12 years ago. He was past 40 by Blackwell's best reckoning, and the wife 29 last April. 2 children still born, a boy dead of fever at 6 months. Black hair, black eyes, she spoke a passable French from her mother's family in Brighton, which had kept her popular with a certain class of continental customers. By all accounts, a friendly woman and attractive. William ran his hand over the back of his neck.
What do you mean, friendly?
Friendly, sir. With the working men.
She was a prostitute.
No, sir.
She was a flirt.
Blackwell looked uncomfortable.
Shorter himself is considered by everyone a gentle giant, he said. A very big man, sir, but no one I spoke to ever heard of him getting into a temper or raising a hand to anyone. He's known by the art students nearby as a soft touch for a bottle or a hot meal. But one student, sir, a James McKinnon, saw Shorter once mad as a hornet. It seems he had received a letter by mistake addressed to his wife, and in this letter were certain inappropriate details. I understand he opened the letter in front of Mr. McKinnon.
A love letter?
An assignation, sir.
Isn't that the same thing?
Sometimes.
So he's a gentle giant except where his wife is concerned. And where's his wife now?
Visiting a sick aunt in France.
William frowned. I see.
It seems she left rather abruptly, sir. No one has heard from her in 6 weeks, though Shorter insists she has written him several times.
And the letters?
Burned accidentally. Misplaced. Eaten by stray cats.
What about the good doctor's blind insects? Is there a cellar?
I couldn't say, sir. Not yet, at least.
William was shaking his head.
Is that it? A wife visiting sick relatives and a man with a temper?
Blackwell frowned. He said a constable had met Shorter during his investigations, and the man had expressed no interest at all in the ruse of the inheritance. He said the tavern keeper had looked at the sketch and said he had never seen the woman, but several customers identified her as Ellen Shorter. All of this struck the constable as curious, but there were several other leads to pursue, and at the time they were still seeking Charlotte Reckitt. He said yesterday a witness had come forward with information about a possible suspect for the theft of the Farquhar painting, a man complaining of a pocket watch stolen on an American liner just after the New Year, and that after interviewing the witness, he had happened to pass by another interrogation of an elderly man reporting his missing daughter. Blackwell wiped at his nose with a red handkerchief, and William recognized it as his own. The inspector told him this elderly man had come into the city from Brighton, and that his daughter was missing.